Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Gourmet Foods, 120 Krispy Kreme Drive, just off Veterans Parkway in Washington in Bloomington, serving Bloomington, Normal, and surrounding cities with gourmet cheeses, chocolates, olives, and foods from around the world. A grand opening taste testing day will be held Saturday, April 1st. World Gourmet Foods, 309-663-2222.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we will talk some about the exploration of Mars. And our guest for the program is Cornell University astronomer Stephen Squires. His special area of interest and research is planetary science, and he has been currently still the scientific principal investigator for the Mars Exploration Rover Project. And maybe you will remember this, the twin robotic explorers named Spirit and Opportunity landed on Mars in January of 2004, and they have added a lot to our understanding of that planet. We'll talk a little bit this morning about the rovers and about what we have learned about Mars with our guest. He's here visiting the campus and will give a lecture on this very topic tonight at 7 o'clock in the Folinger Auditorium. So people who are interested in and around Champaign-Urbana can certainly stop by. He's also authored a book entitled Roving Mars, published by Hyperion. Came out in hardcover last August and will be out back in May, if you would like to read about that. He's been involved in a number of planetary spaceflight missions. He was an associate of the Voyager imaging science team. He was involved in analysis of imaging data from the encounters with Jupiter and Saturn. He was a radar investigator on the Magellan mission to Venus. And as I said, he's continued to be involved with the Mars Exploration Rover Project. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, people have questions they can call. Well, thanks very much.
Oh, it's good to be here.
I think maybe we should refresh people's memory here now about the rovers. It probably has been a while.
It has been a while,
been
yeah.
Really big and in the news. And maybe people will remember the really dramatic photographs that came back.
Still coming back.
And it were just really just stunning, stunning images. Tell us again the basics about Rover and what Rover was intended to do.
Well, their job is to be robot geologists, you know, robotic explorers. We would love to go there ourselves. You know, what I'd really like is Martian dust on my own boots, okay? But we're not ready to do that. And so these are our surrogates, and we've designed them with very human capabilities. They have 20/20 vision. They have the ability to move at will across the Martian surface. Each one of them has an arm that has the same dimensions as your arm. And on the end of the arm, there are various instruments for looking at the things that we find. And so they go there and they do exactly what you would do if you were an explorer on the scene. They'll stop someplace, look around, you know, take pictures, and then we'll decide where we'd like them to go. And we send them there. And then when they find something interesting, they look at it up close with a microscope to see what it looks like in detail, with spectrometers to find out what it's made of. And their job is to learn whether or not Mars once had what it takes to support life. Right now, Mars is a just cold, dry, desolate world. But what we're learning is that in the past, it was different. It was warmer. It was wetter. It was more Earth-like. And we've learned this by reading the story in the rocks with these rovers.
Yeah. When the mission was planned and first started out, the idea was that the basic part of the mission, the active part of the mission, would last for 3 months.
That was the design goal. So 3 months was when the warranty expired. That's the best way to look at it.
And still yet today?
Yeah.
You're still getting
data. They're both still going strong. Yeah. They're both still working. They're aging. They're starting to slowly show signs of wear. But they're both still going. Yeah.
Did it surprise you and the other folks that they have lasted as long as they have?
Yes, it did. Now, you know, when we say it's going to last for 90 days, that doesn't mean that we think the wheels are going to fall off on day 91 when the sun comes up. Okay. We had some margin built in. And if you had, you know, sat me down before we landed and given me truth serum and said, okay, Squires, how long do you really think they're going to last? I would have said 120, 150, maybe 180 days, okay? But today is day 794, and that we never expected. The reason they've lasted this long has been a combination of things. Partly it was we built good hardware. You know, we built good stuff, we tested it, and we're very proud of the hardware that we built. But mostly it's been luck. We thought the thing that would kill the vehicles was going to be dust on the solar panels. They're solar powered. They get their energy from the sun. And Mars is a dusty place. Dust settles from the atmosphere. And we thought it was just going to coat the solar arrays, and eventually the vehicles would die because they didn't have enough electrical power. And in fact, Spirit was very close to death about 400 Martian days ago. And then we had this wonderful, fortuitous gust of wind that simply cleaned the vehicles off, and it was almost good as new again. Mm-hmm. So we've had some real luck, too.
Tell us a little bit more about what it is that you've found. As you say, one of the big questions that you hope that you would learn more about or get a better answer to was there ever liquid water on the planet? Because you can't have life without water. And that you have found geological evidence that would suggest, that would point to the fact that, yes, in fact, there was liquid water, and there was a lot of it, apparently.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's important to realize that it has been realized since a long time ago, like back in the early 70s when the Mariner 9 orbiter went to Mars, that there had probably once been liquid water flowing across the surface. I mean, from orbit, you can see channels and valleys and evidence that water has flowed on the surface. So it wasn't simply we're going there to see if there had ever been liquid water on Mars, because it was pretty well, there's pretty solid evidence of that already. Instead, what we were really trying to do was to characterize in more detail what the environment was really like. If you had been there on Mars at that place 3.5 billion years ago, what was that world like? How suitable was it for life? We landed two vehicles in two very different places. One of them, Spirit, we landed in what we thought was, and in fact still think was, a lake bed. That there's a big crater with a dried up riverbed flowing into it, and we figured it must have filled up with water, right? There was a lake there. What we discovered once we got on the ground is that, yeah, it probably was a lake once upon a time, but it had been covered with lava since then. We didn't know that till we landed. Mm-hmm. So we landed looking for sedimentary rocks, and instead we got a bunch of lava. So that landing site didn't turn out as we expected. Now, since then, we've been able to drive up into some nearby hills and discover lots of other things. But what we have not really found at that site is evidence for lots and lots of water. On the other side of the planet, however, it's a different story. Opportunity landed in a region that we now know was soaked with liquid beneath the surface, where liquid would rarely but occasionally come to the surface and form probably little shallow pools, and the water would flow across the surface and leave little ripples in the rocks that we see preserved. The rocks there are made largely of salts, sulfate salts, which is the kind of thing that would happen that you would get when the water evaporated away and left salts behind. When I say water, what it really was actually a fairly concentrated sulfuric acid. We see minerals that only form under very acidic conditions, and they're sulfate minerals, so that points to sulfuric acid. It would have been a very strange sort of environment. It's the kind of environment that would have been suitable for some forms of life. I mean, you can go to places on Earth where the groundwater or the surface water is sulfuric acid, and it's teeming with microbes that have managed to evolve so that they can survive in that environment. Whether there was actually life in this environment on Mars, we have no idea. Absolutely not a clue. But we have learned a great deal about what the environment actually was like. There have been some real surprises.
Yeah. Well, is just going back to this idea that there is indication that was at one time flowing water, I'm thinking, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that at some point people thought, well, it's possible that that might have been a result of volcanic activity, and maybe that was lava flowing and not water.
It's been suggested that it could be lava flows. It's been suggested that those things, some of them could have been carved by glaciers, carbon dioxide. I mean, there have been a number of hypotheses proposed. In this particular instance, at this location, we're now quite certain about the water interpretation. Whether you can apply that to the rest of the planet or not, good question. It's a big planet.
Yeah. All the signs point to the fact that at some point in the past, Mars was a different planet than it is now.
It changed. The conditions there dramatically changed. It is very cold, very dry today. And it was quite different in the distant past.
any what's the thought about – well, my first question would be, what's the thought about how long ago this was?
Yeah.
And the other question would be, what's anybody's thinking about what happened?
Okay. I can answer the first question a lot better than I can answer the second
well,
question.
Well, that's maybe just a matter of, at this point, a lot of conjecture.
Yeah. The first question is how long ago – a long time. The planet is, like Earth, 4.5 billion years old. And for probably the last 3 or 3.5 billion years, it has been mostly cold and dry. I mean, we see very powerful evidence of that, particularly at the Spirit landing site, that it's been really, really dry for and cold for the last 3, 3.5 billion years. As for why it changed, that's a good question. The idea that scientists have had for a long time about this was that it was in the past, Mars had a greenhouse effect. A dense atmosphere of carbon dioxide, and that because you had this dense CO2 atmosphere, you had a greenhouse effect, the climate was warmer, and then somehow the CO2 went away. So where'd it go? The idea people always had was that where the CO2 went was it went down onto the surface to make carbonate rocks, limestone. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so we went to Mars expecting and hoping and prepared to search for and find lots and lots of carbonate rocks, lots of limestone. There's been none. We have found absolutely none, and neither has anybody else with, looking down from orbit. Turns out that if the groundwater is sulfuric acid, you can't make limestone. And so there's some other answer, and I don't have it. I don't know what it is, but it isn't that one.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Stephen Squires. He's professor of astronomy at Cornell, and his special area of interest is planetary sciences. He's also the scientific principal investigator for the Mars Exploration Rover Project, and he is here visiting the campus. We'll be talking about some of the things that we have learned as a result of sending the rovers to Mars. His talk is tonight at 7 in the Follinger Auditorium. It's sponsored by the folks in the Department of Astronomy and also at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, and it is free and open to the public, so anybody who is interested should stop by. Here on the program as well, we'll take your questions, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Past the questions about was there water on Mars and what was the planet like in the past, what this leads to is this big question that everybody wants to know.
Yeah.
Was there ever life
right.
on the planet?
Right.
And that's something that it's been really difficult to answer that question so far, and may be, in fact, we're not going to be able to answer it until we can actually – well, we've got to get stuff there from there and bring it back. We don't
right.
necessarily have to send a person,
right.
but there's got to be some way to collect stuff and bring it back so that we can really look at it more.
Yeah. What you want to do is go to places on Mars where the conditions were right for life and get samples and bring them back to Earth, put them into the best laboratories on Earth, take them apart almost literally molecule by molecule and find out what's in that stuff. We actually have rocks from Mars on Earth. Occasionally, meteorites from Mars. You know, what will happen is an asteroid will crash into Mars and it will blast stuff off into space. And some of these chunks of rock will drift around in space for a long time and will eventually impact the Earth. But these are rocks that just came from somewhere on Mars. We don't know where. They weren't carefully chosen, obviously. And, a lot of Mars is not all that geologically interesting. A lot of Mars is just covered by lava, as, in fact, one of our landing sites is. So you want to go to these special places yeah. where there was water at the surface and then get those rocks and bring them back.
What I'm sure people will remember is that a few years ago, there was a lot of news generated because someone picked up a meteorite
yes.
from Mars
oh,
in
yeah.
Antarctica. And someone looked at it and hypothesized that there was evidence in that rock of fossilized
right.
microbial life.
Right.
And this was something that's been very controversial.
Yes.
Some scientists looked at it and said, no, sorry, we don't think that's right. Apparently, there are some other scientists who are still prepared to argue that no, in fact, they think that that is right. So that's still sort of a continuing conversation. What are the chances that if you could do this, what you say we need to do, go there, look around, look for the best possible sites, collect material, bring them back, that what you would find would be any more conclusive than what we have now, or would people still be arguing about
that's it? That's impossible to guess because you don't know what you're going to find. The rock that you mention is a piece of volcanic rock. It's not the kind of thing that you would expect necessarily to find fossils in. The rocks at the Opportunity site are sedimentary rocks. And they are rocks that precipitated out from liquid water. So the chances are much, much better in a material like that. Now, as for what you would actually find, no way of knowing until you bring it back. It's exploration. You can't tell. But you want to give it your best shot. And the best shot is not to pick a rock that just literally fell from the sky.
Yeah. So are there people talking about planning such a mission?
Oh, yeah. Sample return missions have been talked about for a long time. It's a very, very challenging mission. You have to take a launch pad and a rocket to the surface of Mars. Okay? Mm-hmm. You take a rover. The rover drives around, picks up rocks, brings it back, stuffs it into the nose cone of the rocket, and then you have to crank this rocket up, shoot it into space. You put into orbit around Mars a spacecraft that's about the size of a coconut that has rocks, little rock samples in it, and then some other spacecraft in orbit around Mars has to find that coconut, gather it in, and bring it back to Earth and have it land successfully on the surface of Earth. It's a very, very technically challenging mission.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with the caller here. We have some. One, and others are welcome too. This is in a Belgium community, not all that far away, here on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. The question I would like for your guest is there a magnetosphere around Mars?
Mars does not have its own internally generated magnetic field anymore. It used to, apparently. There are places on the surface of Mars where there are very old rocks where you can see that there is a magnetic field that is kind of frozen into those rocks, sort of preserved from billions of years ago. What it's suggesting is that Mars once had its own magnetic field, and then that magnetic field kind of turned off at some point during its history. And the most likely explanation, the best way to generate a magnetic field is if you have a core of iron that's liquid, that's molten, and so it's able to convect and flow and move. And the best explanation is that Mars once had something like that, but then as the planet cooled, that solid, that liquid core became solid. It froze, and the magnetic field turned off.
Couldn't that be responsible for the lack of atmosphere?
That could be one of the contributors, because if you have a magnetic field, what that can do is it can protect the planet's atmosphere from the solar wind. And then when the magnetic field goes away, the solar wind can help to kind of erode away the atmosphere. So that's definitely a possible contributor to that story. Yeah, absolutely.
Does the dryness kind of relate to the time that the magnetosphere disappeared?
Hard to say exactly, but it coincides reasonably well.
Sounds like a suspicious character to me.
It is suspicious. Absolutely. You're right.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Good
Other
question.
Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm just curious about you. You can talk a little bit about how it is you became an astronomer, because we just chatted a little bit before we got going, and the one thing I know is that you started out in geology.
That's
and
right.
And there went to planetary science. How did you get into astronomy?
Well, I started off in geology because I liked doing science and I liked climbing mountains, and I figured it was a way to combine the two. But after I studied geology as an undergraduate, and after two or three years of this, what I came to realize was that the geologists who have been studying this planet for the last couple of hundred years have done a pretty darn good job of figuring stuff out. Now, that's not to say there isn't lots of good geology left to be done, but what I craved was kind of more of a blank canvas, you know, some place that nobody really knew anything about. And there just aren't places left on the Earth that are totally unexplored anymore, really. And then when I was a junior, my third year in college at Cornell, I took a course that was being offered on the results of the Viking mission to Mars, which was flying at the time. And I was an undergraduate, but it was a graduate level course, and so we were expected to write a term paper that was some piece of original research. And I remember a few weeks into the semester thinking, okay, I better start working on my term paper. And I went into this room where they kept all the pictures from Mars. And this is before CD-ROMs and the internet and all of that. They were just on these big rolls of photographic paper. And I remember going in there and sitting down, and I thought, you know, I'd sit down for 15 or 20 minutes and flip through some pictures and try to come up with a topic for my term paper. And I was in that room for 4 hours, just going through those pictures, and I was just stunned by what I was seeing. I mean, here was a world that no one knew anything about. And I walked out of that room knowing exactly what I wanted to do with the rest of my life.
Yeah. Well, I remember we were talking about the fact that the rovers have sent back a lot of photographs, and
yeah,
they were the best pictures that we had ever had,
mm-hmm,
of Mars,
yep,
and certainly the best pictures that we'd ever had of the surface of another planet,
Yeah.
And I remember seeing them, and maybe it was a newspaper, maybe it was a magazine, seeing the photo. And I was kind of stunned myself, and I just sat there kind of thinking to myself, this is Mars.
Yeah.
This is the surface of Mars. And somehow I couldn't quite wrap my head around the idea that this, in fact, was a picture taken on the surface of another planet. Did even you, when you saw those pictures, did you think to yourself, man,
this is Mars. You know, surface. I mean, we knew going in what kind of quality pictures to expect. It was interesting when we were first designing these things. You know, you got to design a camera. Okay, well, how good does it have to be? The better the resolution, the more pixels, the more complicated, the more expensive it is, the more bandwidth you need to get the data back to Earth and so forth. So you got to make decisions. How good do we make it? And so we sat down and thought, well, okay, what are these things supposed to do? You know, they're robotic geologists. Now, how good does a geologist's vision have to be? 20/20 works, right? I mean, you know, that's the standard. So we gave them 20/20 vision, exactly. We worked out the numbers and we gave them the exact equivalent of human 20/20 vision. And so when you see those pictures, they look exactly as it would to your eyes if you were there on the surface. There's an IMAX film about the project that just came out. In fact, I think probably the closest place to hear it's playing is in Indianapolis. But we've taken those images on Mars, and then the filmmakers took those same images and converted them to IMAX format. And they convert to IMAX format beautifully because 20/20 is what you need for IMAX resolution. And you can sit in that IMAX theater and look at those things, and it's like being on Mars. It's just, it's fabulous. And yeah, there's this, you know, it's so easy when you're in a business like this to get so wrapped up in the details of the pixels and the commands and the data analysis and so forth that you lose sight of the wonder of it all. And every now and then it's fun to just kind of sit back and go, oh my God, look at this stuff. This really is Mars.
Mm. So for you that as a geologist or for someone who's trying to understand Mars better, you're getting a picture of rocks and the surface and the material that's
right.
as good as you would get is if you were standing there looking at it.
Exactly.
But still the shortcoming is you can't reach down and pick up the thing and
right.
hold it. I mean, how much more could you now, obviously, if you could take it and you could work on it in the laboratory, you could learn a lot more. But I guess I'm thinking of what are the shortcomings of on the one hand, being able to see very clearly what it is, but not being there and present and not being able to do much.
Well, the one thing you got to realize is that the pictures are only a small part of the story. We've actually got six different instruments on each rover, of which the cameras that you mentioned are only one. Mm-hmm. Okay. On the front end of the vehicle, there's an arm, okay, with an elbow and a shoulder and a wrist, and it's got four fingers on its hand. Okay. One of those fingers is a microscope, very high resolution microscope. Another one is a grinding tool. We call it the RAT. RAT, the rock abrasion tool, and it's really more like a polishing tool. You can grind away several millimeters of a rock surface and then polish the surface, and you can really look inside the rock. And then the other two are spectrometers, the kind of stuff that you would have in a laboratory. Not that, you know, these aren't things that geologists carry in the field with them, that will tell us in detail what chemical elements and what minerals are present in the rock. So we carry a pretty powerful analytical toolkit with us. There are still frustrations, you know. I've seen rocks that, man, I just wish you could turn it over. You know,
yeah.
Isn't there just a way to pick this thing up and turn it over? You know, and we didn't carry that capability. Now, occasionally, we will flip rocks with our wheels or something accidentally, but we don't have the kind of dexterity to handle things that you would have if you had a human on the surface. But still, they carry a lot of capability, and those spectrometers in particular have really been a huge part of uncovering this whole story. I mean, the business of finding out that the water was sulfuric acid, that kind of thing. We could have only learned that with those spectrometers, which are really like laboratory instruments.
We're at our midpoint here. Our guest is Stephen Squires. He's professor of astronomy at Cornell. He's a planetary scientist, and he is the scientific principal investigator for the Mars Exploration Rover Project. You may remember these two crafts, these two rovers, one of them called Spirit and the other Opportunity, landed in January of 2004. The effective mission was supposed to last 3 months, but they have continued to last to this day, He says they're starting to get tired, but they have continued to provide a lot of data about Mars and have helped us learn more about that planet and its past. He is going to give a talk about this very subject, and mission update, recent results from the Mars exploration rovers. That's 7 o'clock tonight in the Follinger Auditorium on the U of I campus, and it is free and open to the public. So if you want to go by and hear what he has to say, you can do that. Here on the program, if you have a question, you can ask that, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. The way these things work, as I understand it, is if you want the rover to do something, you have to send a command.
Yep.
And it takes time to get there.
Yes.
And then it takes time to figure out whether it did what you wanted it to do. So there's this big lag time.
Yes.
That's just a function of the distance between here and Mars. How? So do you give it a command and then you go out for coffee or something and then you come back later and see what happened? How does that work?
It depends on where you are in the mission. Even during the most intensive phases of the mission, there was no way to really control it in real time. I mean, the night we landed, okay, it was on nationwide television. There was this television picture that showed everybody in the control room. Well, I'm here to tell you, we had a lot of things in the control room, but one thing that we didn't have was control. We were spectators, just like the people watching on TV. Even at that point, when Mars and Earth were very relatively close together, it took 10 minutes traveling at the speed of light for a radio command to get from Earth to Mars, and another 10 minutes for the data to come back. Compared to that 20-minute round trip time, the amount of time that the vehicle took from when it hit the top of the Martian atmosphere to when it was on the surface was 6 minutes. So we had no control in the control room whatsoever. We were just watching. Today, it's even more delay involved. The way we do it now, part of it is that we've come to really trust the vehicles. You know, they're on the surface. They've been there for a couple years now. We built them to be able to look after themselves pretty well. And it turns out they can do it. So we actually only command them once a day. So we don't send commands and then go get a cup of coffee. We send commands and go home and go to sleep. And then we come in the next morning to see what happened. So we send commands once a day, and the vehicles do what we ask them to, or they don't. Sometimes it's both. They have a lot of personality. Then we come back the next morning and we see what happened and we do it again.
And the people who designed this designed sort of an unconventional method for landing these things.
Yeah.
This
that's one way of putting it.
Crash landing that was like, as I remember it, it was almost like the vehicle, the thing that contained it was surrounded by airbags.
Exactly.
And you smacked it right into the planet.
That's right.
The hope was that it would take the shot.
That's right.
And that the bags would deflate and then the thing would kind of open up and rover would come rolling out.
Exactly.
As you were waiting for this thing to hit, were there people there? Was everybody just have their fingers crossed and hope that it didn't get smashed to pieces by the landing?
Yeah. The thing about landing on Mars is that because you don't have that real time control, I mean, we can't steer it down to the surface and see big rocks and avoid them. What you have to do instead is build a landing system that is robust to any kinds of obstacles that you might find. Now, it turns out that it's not possible, at least with the technology that we have available to us at this time, to build a landing system that is absolutely robust to everything that Mars might throw at you. You know, we built a very tough landing system. Those airbags are made of very, very tough material. They're made of stuff called Vectran, which is really, really tough stuff. It's a very, very capable landing system. But, you know, one big, sharp, pointy rock in just the wrong place or one terrible gust of wind at just the wrong time can kill the vehicle. And so you don't know what Mars is going to throw at you. Plus, you know, we could have made a mistake. There could have been some bad wiring in there that we didn't know about. I mean, we tested it as thoroughly as we could. But yeah, when the thing's landing, man, your heart's in your throat.
Yeah. Well, and it shows you that things can go wrong, that there was another attempt. Which was not a success. Now, and I'm not exactly sure if they figured out what went wrong. This was a European effort, or was it just a British?
It was a British lander called Beagle 2. And no, they don't know exactly what went wrong. The most likely scenario, I think, is that it turns out that when we landed, Our vehicles landed only about a week or so. Our first vehicle, Spirit, landed only about a week or so after the Beagle 2 mm-hmm. landing attempt. And at the time, there had been a minor dust storm on Mars. And when there's a dust storm and dust gets raised in the atmosphere, the structure of the atmosphere changes. We knew about that. The British team knew about that. Our vehicle was designed so that we could actually change some of the entry system parameters. In other words, when the vehicle is coming in, you have to decide how to open the parachute, what altitude to open the parachute at. And where you want to do that depends on what the atmosphere is like at the time. We were able to make changes. The design of the British lander did not allow that, and so the atmospheric conditions may have done them in. Mm-hmm. But that's just conjecture. The symptom was they simply never heard from their vehicle.
Well, we have several callers now. In fact, the lines are full. So let's talk with these folks. We'll start with someone in Indiana, in Terre Haute, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello. Thank mm-hmm. you very much.
Sure.
Great show. I was curious about the if the guest could talk a little more about the spectrometer and how that works.
Well, we've actually got three different spectrometers. They have three different jobs. One of them is mounted on the same mast at the top of the rover as the cameras, and it's an infrared spectrometer. You know, if you had infrared vision, rocks would look very different to you than they do with your eyes. With an infrared spectrometer, you can look off into the distance. You can tell different rocks and different minerals apart from one another. So a granite looks very different from a basalt and so forth. So we use that to look off in the distance and find rocks that might have an interesting composition. On the end of the arm, there are two spectrometers. One of them is an X-ray spectrometer, and its job is to look for different chemical elements. So we can use that spectrometer to find out how much silicon, how much iron, how much magnesium, how much calcium, and so forth there is in the rock. We also have a device called a Mossbauer spectrometer, and that's that uses gamma rays to determine what minerals are present. So pyroxene, olivine, different kinds of sulfates, any mineral. It turns out that the way this instrument works, you have to have iron in the mineral for us to be able to detect what kind of mineral it is. But of course, Mars, red planet, there's lots of iron minerals there, and so that was why we chose that instrument. And we can use that to determine the mineral composition of the rocks. So the ensemble of those together tells us a lot about what the rocks are made of.
All right, well, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Let's go next to someone in here in Champaign County, line 1. Hello.
Hello there. Down the hall. Yeah, on rocks, you mentioned the lack of carbonate rocks.
Right.
Now, that's my understanding of that. Whoops, is sedentary deposition mainly, and that means has an implication for any kind of. To my mind, has a, I want you to comment. Any kind of widespread, similar to Terra life, in the sense that the carbon dioxide in Earth's atmosphere was taken out of by organisms, I understand, generally. That's sort of the line I've heard. So if you haven't established any presence of these at all, it would mean that there wouldn't, you know, it doesn't rule out life entirely, but it would rule out any kind of earlier stage of widespread planetary. At least that's the implication. I'd like to comment on that. I'll hang up. But I also wanted to mention, I think I heard that you guys came up with a parking plan for solar absorption, right? Well, you tried to find the right inclination to get through, to sort of tilt your solar panels toward to get a better angle on the sun during the Martian winter or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Let me talk about both of those. As far as the formation of carbonate rocks, for many types of carbonates that are formed on Earth, organisms play a role in precipitating the carbonates, but that's not a requirement. You can perfectly well make carbonates without organisms being present. So the presence or absence of carbonate rocks doesn't really tell you much, pro or con, about the presence or absence of organisms on Mars. It simply tells you that the chemical conditions were not right for making carbonates. With respect to your second question, yeah, we have used the tilt of the terrain as kind of a trick to preserve the lifetime of these rovers. the rovers do not include, because it would be too heavy, too complex, any kind of big mechanism for taking the solar panels and sort of tilting them so they point towards the sun. But what we can do is, if the sun, say, during the winter is low in the northern sky, as it is when you're in the southern hemisphere of Mars, where we are with the Spirit rover, what we can do is drive the vehicle onto north-facing slopes so that the whole vehicle tilts to the north, and the solar arrays then tilt to the north, and you get more sunlight on the panels. And in fact, we survived last winter on Mars with Spirit in large part because we were able to climb onto the north-facing slopes of a big hill and tilt the solar arrays towards the sun.
Okay. I have someone on a cell phone. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
So the science is absolutely wondrous, but you know, Mars has been also the subject of wondrous fiction, and the question that I have for you is probably more lighthearted. So when you go back and read Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles, given that the science has said that none of this could be true, does The Martian Chronicles still stir your soul? So that's my question, and I'll leave from there.
All right.
Absolutely. I mean, you can the mere fact that we now understand what Mars is really like in no way takes away from the quality of fiction that has been written about the planet. Imagination is a wonderful thing, and Mars provides a setting that can be a backdrop for all sorts of imaginative stories. And I don't see any reason why knowing the reality of the place detracts from the enjoyment of stories written about it in the past or in the future. So, I think it's still wonderful stuff.
Well, with the understanding that the time, if you go back and ask when was it that Mars would have been a different place and maybe more Earth-like, if you're talking about a couple of billion years,
yeah,
even if there had at one time been life on the planet, would it be reasonable that this long afterwards you would be able to find very much?
It's still possible that there is life on Mars today, probably just not close to the surface. If you go deep enough down below the surface, I mean, just like on Earth, you know, on Earth, you go, the deeper you go, the warmer it gets, right? It's going to be the same deal on Mars. Once you go deep enough down, and it may be, you know, thousands of feet, I don't know, but once you go deep enough down, you may get to a temperature where it's warm enough. In fact, you will get to a temperature where it's warm enough that you would expect liquid water to – it'd be possible for liquid water to exist. And so we certainly can't rule out the possibility that there is life, microbial life, mm-hmm. in cracks, in the rocks, in the crust, deep below the surface today. You'd have to drill to find the stuff, but it could be there.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone in Lovington. Another caller here, line number three. Hello.
My whole experience on this is reading Rainbow, believe it or not. I don't know whether you're familiar with that segment where they talked about this. But my question was, how do you survive the weather? And I guess, basically, how was this thing built on a mechanical level to take all the dirt and the dust and everything like that?
Good question. Yeah, the weather is a big deal. I mean, Martian weather is different from weather on Earth. A lot of it has to do with dust storms. The dust storms happen mostly in the summertime. That's when you have the most sunlight shining on the surface. That's when the surface heats up the most and it stirs up the dust. The way you survive it, there are two key points to it. First of all, you worry about dust covering the solar panels. So what we did was we just made really big solar panels. I mean, when we first landed, the solar arrays were putting out way more power than we could possibly use. We over-designed them on purpose so that even when they got dusty, they'd still work reasonably well. The other thing is you worry about dust and grit getting into all the joints, all the, you know, moving parts and so forth. And so we devoted a lot of thought and a lot of attention to carefully sealing all of the mechanisms so that dust and sand could not penetrate into it. And it's actually worked quite well.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have time for other questions in about 10 minutes or so. And let me introduce again the guest. We're talking with Stephen Squires. He's professor of astronomy at Cornell. His special area of interest and research is planetary science. And he serves as the scientific principal investigator for the Mars Exploration Rover Project. He's written a book on this, by the way, if you're interested in reading it. It's entitled Roving Mars, published by Hyperion. It was first published in hardcover last August and will be coming out in May in paperback. Years here visiting the campus, we'll be giving a lecture talking about some of the recent results from the rovers. That's tonight at 7 o'clock in the Follinger Auditorium on the U of I campus. The folks at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications and the Astronomy Department are involved in sponsoring this. And questions are certainly welcome. We do have time for others. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think probably ever since the last human walked on the moon, and that's been a while.
Yeah.
Ever since we were there and left, people have been talking about the need to go back, mm-hmm. To have human beings back on the moon, perhaps establish some kind of permanent presence on the moon, and then the next step would be to go to Mars. People have been talking that for a long time. The Bush administration has sort of endorsed that idea of moving forward there.
That's right.
And here we're talking about, particularly if you're going to go to Mars, significant technical challenges.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I don't think anybody thinks it's impossible, but it's going to be difficult and it's going to cost a lot of money.
That's right.
It's going to be expensive. I won't ask the question, do you think that a human being will ever stand on Mars? Because I expect you would say yes.
Yes.
Someday.
Someday it's going
to happen. Someday it's going to happen. Within our lifetimes, do you think?
I hope so. You know, I'd love to live to see it. You know, it's been 25 years in the future for the last 25 years, so it's probably at least 25 years away. But yeah, I think it's going to happen. It's too tantalizing for us to, as a species, resist it indefinitely.
Yeah. Whenever we've talked about this over the years, I could almost bet money that at least someone would call in and say the same thing that people say often when you're talking about, do you want to spend money on space exploration? And that is, look, we're talking about a lot of money.
Yeah.
We have pressing needs here on the Earth. Why are we spending the money to send someone to Mars? And I think probably it would be difficult to make the argument that we should do this based on pure science, although some people would be fine with that. I'm thinking that you're going to have to say, well, we can give you something more other than just having a picture of somebody standing with a flag,
sure,
on Mars. Is there something that you can say about, can you give a good reason that would yield some payback, an answer to this question, okay, why should we go, why should we put all that effort into it and spend all that money to send a human being to the surface of Mars?
Well, let's talk about the rover mission first in that context and then about sending humans. The rover mission is purely about science. That's it. No Tang, no Teflon, no spinoffs. Okay.
Yeah.
This is pure human knowledge. I mean, that's the reason we sent them. The reason for exploring Mars is to answer basic questions like, are we alone in the universe? How does life first come to be? And that's what our Mars exploration program, our robotic program now, is aimed at learning. Our mission cost, when you add it all up, everything, close to $900 million. That is a lot of money, okay? And we take that number very, very seriously. I mean, when we first landed and we got down on the surface and we thought those vehicles were going to last for like 90 days each, you do the math, that was costing $4.5 million a day. You know, we come into work in the morning thinking, okay, we got to do $4.5 million worth of science today. You know, and some days we did, and there were days that we didn't. But we always had that number in our minds. These missions don't, you know, fill in the potholes. They don't put roofs over people's heads. They don't put textbooks into the schools. But they put knowledge into the textbooks. And I feel very strongly that in a society that is wealthy enough to do a pretty good job, not a perfect job, because we never will, but a pretty good job of taking care of the basic needs of our citizens, that we have, if not an obligation, at least some kind of imperative to spend some fraction of our resources on things that, you know, for lack of a better term, enrich the human spirit. Things like investing money in the arts, investing money in basic research that might not pay off for 100 years, investing money in pure exploration. These address the things that make us human. you know, the quest for beauty, the quest for knowledge. And so I feel pretty good about that 900 million. I think we are adding to the body of human knowledge in a way that is meaningful to most people. Now, when you get to the issue of sending humans, you're talking about a couple of orders of magnitude more money involved. Does the science alone justify that? I think maybe for some people it does. I'm not sure that it does for everybody, though. Then you got to ask, you know, what are the other reasons? What are the other reasons for sending humans into space instead of sending robots if it's not just scientific knowledge? Humans have a capability to inspire in a way that robots never will. Okay, someone once said nobody's ever going to give a robot a ticker tape parade. Okay, and there's something to that. If you look at what were the benefits of sending humans to the moon back in the 60s and early 70s, we learned a lot about the moon. You know, we learned about the origin of the moon, but that scientific knowledge doesn't justify the billions that were spent on Apollo. But those images of members of our species standing on another world, you know, to show that if you sat down and you said, what are humanity's great accomplishments? And ask anybody to put together a list, I think a lot of people would say landing humans on the moon is on that list. And so there's an intangible but important value associated with that as a way of inspiring people. I mean, one of the reasons that, you know, many of the people who work on these Mars rover missions, you know, our team is made up of people who were youngsters back during the days of Apollo. And many of us were inspired to follow a career in space exploration by what we saw on television back when we were kids. Mm-hmm. It has a way of inspiring the next generation of explorers that has some significance too. It's hard to attach a dollar value to, but it's real.
When you talk about the challenges, obviously one would be to make it possible for a human to survive on the surface of Mars. I don't know if that's any more difficult than the moon, for example.
It's probably comparable.
But also a complicating factor is it's a lot further.
Yeah.
And it's going to take longer to get there.
Yep.
So you have to construct an environment that your astronauts can live in
for a long time.
Yeah. It's what, about three, you think about 3 months?
Just to get there is 6 or 7 months.
6 or 7 months, okay.
Yeah. So that's one of the real challenges.
That's a big issue. Would that be the, and obviously we don't really have the lift capability anymore. We'd have to build a new kind of craft.
Right.
You know, there are all kinds of stuff we'd have to do. But is maybe the biggest thing simply the fact that it would take 7 months to get from here to there?
The time is a big part of it because you have to be able to support the astronauts, keep them alive for a much longer period of time, which, you know, there's consumables, there's air, there's water, there's food, there's the stuff you got to take along. Now, there's a lot of thought that maybe you could get some of that on the Martian surface, kind of live off the land. But that's hard, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could grow plants there. Maybe you can extract water from the atmosphere, but it's very difficult to do. You need to carry the fuel necessary to get you off the surface and back to Earth, and that's a lot more fuel than it takes to come back from the moon. So there are a lot of factors involved, you know, associated with the distance that make it much more difficult. Landing is very different on Mars. On the moon, you don't have an atmosphere. On Mars, you do have an atmosphere, and that makes the whole landing process very different. In some ways easier, in some ways harder, but quite different, and so we have to develop new landing techniques. I wouldn't want to land on Mars with airbags myself.
Oh, you think it might be a little shocking?
I think that would be kind of a rough ride. Yeah, it works fine for robots. I wouldn't put humans inside that thing.
Just maybe one of the, we have a couple of minutes here, and maybe one other thing. We're talking about the fact that the rover, really the big question the rover was interested in investigating was, would adding to our store of knowledge of conditions on Mars and whether in the past, it would be possible to life.
Right, exactly.
And also one of the things we know is that, amazingly enough, that there are living things on this Earth in the very harshest environments that this planet has to offer.
Yeah.
Just the absolute worst conditions you
amazing.
Could possibly think of.
Amazing stuff.
There
yeah.
are things that live,
yeah.
which makes you think that, and there are places, even within our solar system, that astronomers look at and think, well, you know, it's not impossible to think that within our solar system there are living things right now.
Right.
Where are the places that are the greatest interest?
Well, you know, I mean, down in the crust of Mars is one, but the one that really tantalizes me, the one that I think may be the best place, is a place called Europa. Europa is one of the moons of Jupiter. And it has a crust of ice, but there's a lot of evidence that suggests that beneath that crust of ice is an ocean of liquid water. So there may be two oceans in the solar system. We got one. Europa's got the other. So if you could design a mission to fly to Jupiter, survive its horrible, you know, charged particle environment and the magnetic field, and somehow get down on the surface of Europa, and then melt or drill your way down through what could be miles of ice, and get to that ocean, and then design a robotic submarine that could swim around in that, you could discover some wonderful things. But boy, that's a hard mission to do.
You could work on that one next.
Oh man, you know it. The reason I'm doing Mars rovers instead of Europa submarines is at least I know how to do Mars rovers. Europa submarines are awfully hard. That's going to be the next generation of
scientists. Some kid. There's some kid out there.
Yeah, there's some kid out there listening to this show who's going to figure that one out, but it ain't me.
Right. Well, we're pretty much at the point here we're going to have to finish up for this part of the show. I want to again mention that our guest, Stephen Squires, astronomer from Cornell, will be giving a talk about some of the recent results from the Mars exploration rovers tonight at 7 o'clock in the Follinger Auditorium, and it is free and open to the public. Anyone interested in attending should feel welcome. And if you'd like to read more about the rover mission, you can look for his book, Roving Mars, published by Hyperion. It first came out in hardcover last August, will be out in paperback in May. Well, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Appreciate it. Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part with funds from the Infant Parent Institute. With offices in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information is available on the web at infantparent.com. Programs here on WILL also made possible with support from Sinfonia da Camera, presenting New World Concert at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, April 1st in the Follinger Great Hall at the Krennert Center for the Performing Arts. More information is available at 333-6280. The Associated Press is reporting this morning that former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger has died. He was 88 years old. He led the Defense Department in the Reagan administration. He also served in the Nixon cabinet, was a central figure in the Iran-Contra scandal of the Reagan era. Certainly there will be more news of this throughout the day from National Public Radio. I'm sure some reflection on who he was in his career as part of All Things Considered, and we'll have those programs for you coming up here on AM 580. A little later today, Celeste Quinn will be talking with photographer David Plowden. He's been recording the American landscape for 40 years now, and over that time he's seen some dramatic changes in the country's small towns and farms. His latest book is Handful of Dust, Photographs of Disappearing America. It's an elegy for our changing landscape, and he will be talking with Celeste Quinn in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. The show itself begins at noon Central Time here on WILL. In the next hour of this show, we'll be talking with South Africa best-known AIDS activist. His name is Zaki Akmat, founder of the Treatment Action Campaign, an effort to pressure the government of South Africa to provide AIDS drugs to all South Africans, particularly